Joseph is a very compelling biblical figure. And the reason why is because of the way his story prefigures Christ. That is going to be the main point of this whole series. If nothing else, I hope that you come to gain a better appreciation for how Joseph and his story is really ultimately about Jesus and his. Joseph gives us an example of somebody who trusts God in hard times, and God is always with him. It's a story that is introduced in Genesis chapter 37, and then it continues on in Genesis 39 through 50. And so my plan is just to work through those chapters with you a section at a time. We'll try to make the practical applications that we ought to make from the examples that we see. And ultimately, we will aim to bring our attention back to the greater story, which is the story of Jesus. And so for this morning, we're going to work our way through Genesis chapter 37. And so if you'd like to follow along in your Bibles, you can open up to Genesis 37. And we'll start just by reading the first four verses of that chapter. It says in verse 1, Jacob lived in the land of his father's sojournings, in the land of Canaan. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was pasturing the flock with his brothers. He was a boy with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his sons, because he was the son of his old age. And he made him a robe of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peacefully to him. Now, this story picks up telling us about Jacob, who, if you have been reading through Genesis and got to this point, you would know is the son of Isaac and a grandson of Abraham. He's also known as Israel, and that's why the text refers to him as Jacob at the beginning, but then Israel in verse 3. His name was changed to Israel after an incident where he wrestled an angel earlier in this book. But his 12 sons will give rise to the 12 tribes of Israel. Jacob's 12 sons become the 12 tribes. Now, Jacob had four wives, and it's helpful to have a little bit of background information about that as we get into this story of Joseph. And so I'm going to try to review some of that with you before we continue on. In chapter 29 of Genesis, Jacob worked for his uncle Laban for 7 years because he wanted to marry Rachel. And at the end of those 7 years, he actually got tricked into marrying Rachel's sister, Leah. One of the most, funny verses in the Bible, I think, is after he marries who he thinks is Rachel, and the verse tells us, and behold, it was Leah. Quite a surprise for him the next morning. But he agrees to work for another 7 years to marry the woman he actually wanted to marry, who was Rachel. And so he works another 7 years for his uncle Laban. And all of this meant that Rachel was Jacob's favorite wife. Genesis 29 and verse 30 tells us explicitly, he loved Rachel more than Leah. But as it turns out, Leah is the one who is actually able to bear children. And so, in Genesis 29, Leah has four sons in succession: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. But then Rachel becomes jealous because she hasn't been able to conceive, and so she comes up with her own solution, which is to give her maidservant Bilhah to Jacob so that he can conceive through her. Maybe she thinks that because Bilhah is her servant that she sort of gets half credit for this. Sort of reminds you a little bit of Abraham and Sarah and Hagar, the way she comes into the picture. But what happens is Rachel gives her servant Bilhah to Jacob, and Bilhah bears Jacob's fifth and sixth sons, Dan and Naphtali. And when Leah sees what Rachel does, Leah becomes jealous of that situation, so she takes her servant Zilpah and gives him to Jacob for his fourth wife. And Zilpah bears Jacob's seventh and eighth sons, Gad and Asher. Then Leah gets pregnant again, and Leah bears the ninth and tenth sons, Issachar and Zebulun. And then finally, after years of being barren, the Lord opens Rachel's womb, and Rachel is the one who gives birth to Joseph and Benjamin. Now, this background information, I think, is really helpful for us because it helps us to understand two things very clearly. And the first one is, this is a very messed up family. There is nothing about this that is healthy. There is nothing about this that is good. Occasionally, people will mention that, well, the Bible doesn't really condemn polygamy. In the Old Testament, we see people who have multiple wives, and I always want to ask, have you read those stories? You can't read these stories and think this is a good thing that brings blessings or pleases God. But this is a very messed up family. It's a very messed up situation. And what that helps us to see is that God can take messed up families and messed up situations and bring about something really good. And so though Jacob and all of these people involved have created this really tangled up web, God is able to untangle it and bring about good things from it. But the second thing that this helps us to understand for our purposes this morning is that Joseph is Jacob's favorite son. He is the firstborn son of his favorite wife, who struggled to conceive for many years. And Rachel actually died giving birth to Benjamin in chapter 35 of Genesis. And so maybe Jacob's association with Benjamin is a little bit bittersweet. He had a second son from Rachel, but it was at the cost of the life of the woman that he loved. And so in Jacob's eyes, Joseph represents everything that's right in the world. He is the favorite son of his favorite wife. He sets his affection on him in a particular way, and he becomes the apple of his eye. But by showing him favoritism, Jacob is actually repeating the same mistake that his father made. Don't you remember what Isaac's relationship was like with Jacob and Esau? Back in Genesis 25 through 27, Isaac loved Esau more than Jacob. Isaac liked how Esau went out and hunted, and so he set his affections on Esau in a special way, and Jacob manipulated him in order to receive a blessing that really wasn't due for him. But just like Isaac loved Esau more than Jacob, Jacob loves Joseph more than all of his other sons, and that leads to all kinds of family problems. The applications, I think, are obvious for us here, but we might as well say them out loud. Number one, don't have a favorite wife. And number two, don't have a favorite child. The first part really just sort of takes care of itself as long as you limit yourself to one. That is pretty easy. The second part, though, needs to also be consciously avoided. And the way that we can be careful that we don't have a favorite child is simply by remembering what love is really all about. Love is at its core about selflessness. It's about thinking about somebody else more than yourself. And the sad reality is that sometimes parents are tempted to show favoritism to their favorite child. Sometimes they don't even hide it very well, and that's really sad. But we need to remember that real love is selfless. If we love others, it's about them. It's not about us. And so parents who love their children the way they should will love them all equally. They won't favor the one who does the best in sports or the one who does best in school or even the ones who do best in Bible class. they will love them all equally. Favoritism isn't good for anybody, including the one who is favored. But because of Jacob's favoritism of Joseph, he gives him a special robe, which we just read about here in Genesis 37 in verse 3. Now, the ESV says he made him a robe of many colors. That's the traditional interpretation. That's what most translations say, that Jacob gave Joseph a robe of many colors. And many of you probably have memories of being in Bible class and coloring a coat that has like multicolored stripes. You can see I've even drawn on that imagery a little bit for my background here. And that may very well be the case. It may very, very well be that he had a robe of many colors. Other translators think, though, that maybe this Hebrew word means the robe was very long or extravagant. Maybe it had long sleeves that weren't really fit for work. It was more of a showy kind of garment. Maybe it was very elaborately embroidered. It doesn't really matter what it looked like. The point is that it was special. The point is that Jacob gave Joseph a robe that stood out, and it incited the jealousy of his brothers. It made his brothers seethe with hatred. And as we just read in verse 2, it says that they were all tending sheep together, and Joseph came back with a bad report to his father Jacob. Now, people are a little bit divided about that. Was Joseph sort of being a tattletale? Was he out of line for going and telling Jacob this? Or was he maybe even making it up to some degree? I don't think so, though. Knowing what I know about Joseph and knowing what I know about Joseph's brothers, I think that Joseph gave an accurate report. And I think that he felt like it was his responsibility to tell his father about the bad work that his brothers were doing. They were being trusted by him to do their jobs. And if they weren't doing a good job, he needed to know about it. But you can understand how this bad report would have gotten underneath their skin. You know, maybe the fields seemed like a place where they could escape their father's favoritism at home. You know, when they saw the way that Jacob looked at Joseph and the way that Jacob treated Joseph and the way that Jacob singled out Joseph, he probably gave him, you know, extra dessert at dinner and stuff like that. But to get out of the house and to go to the field and to go to work, that was the place where they could get away from all of the nauseating dynamics of this relationship. But now here comes Joseph, making that place difficult for them too. When Joseph brings some accountability to their work, his presence in the field becomes just as nauseating as his presence at home. And so when Jacob gives Joseph this special robe, it's a very tangible representation of the dynamic that they all felt. And in verse 4, it says, they hated him and could not speak peacefully to him. But it gets worse. Continuing on in verse 5, it says, now Joseph had a dream. And when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, hear this dream that I have dreamed. Behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and behold, my sheaf arose and stood upright. And behold, your sheaves gathered around it and bowed down to my sheaf. His brother said to him, are you indeed to reign over us? Or are you indeed to rule over us? So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Then he dreamed another dream and told it to his brothers and said, behold, I have dreamed another dream. Behold, the sun, the moon, and 11 stars were bowing down to me. But when he told it to his father and to his brothers, his father rebuked him and said to him, what is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brothers indeed come to bow ourselves to the ground before you? And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind. Now, these are not mere dreams. I have some weird dreams sometimes, but I don't feel compelled to go and tell people about them most of the time. But I think that it's clear that these are divine revelations. Joseph understands that there's something particular about these dreams that's being communicated to him by God. And God often spoke to people like this in Old Testament times, in dreams or in visions or even by an audible voice. And Joseph understands that these are divine revelations. Otherwise, I don't think he would have felt compelled to share them. Unless Joseph was just incredibly dense and incredibly socially awkward and unaware, he would have understood what this would mean for his home life, telling people about these dreams. Because the interpretations are immediately obvious. His brothers understand right away what it means. His father understands right away what it means. Joseph is destined for power, and God intends to exalt him over the rest of his family. And the second dream is especially offensive, because not only are his 11 brothers represented by sheaves, but his father and his mother are represented by the sun and the moon. Now, keep in mind, as we talked about earlier, Joseph's mother, Rachel, is already dead at this point. She died giving birth to Benjamin back in Genesis chapter 35. And so you can imagine why this dream would be especially upsetting to Jacob. It would feel almost like Joseph was rubbing salt in the wound, a wound that was surely still fresh and painful in Jacob's heart. But not only is this dream disrespectful, it also seems like utter nonsense. How on earth could it even be fulfilled? What is he talking about? How could your mother and your father and all your brothers actually do this? This is nonsense, Joseph. But verse 11 gives us a clue that Jacob may have understood there was more to this. Because it says there, "But his father kept the saying in mind." And so perhaps there was something about these dreams that made him think that there was something to them. But the story continues in verse 12. "Now his brothers went to pasture their father's flock near Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, 'Are not your brothers pasturing the flock at Shechem? Come, I will send you to them.' And he said to him, 'Here I am.' So he said to him, 'Go now, see if it is well with your brothers and with the flock, and bring me word.' So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. And a man found him wandering in the fields. And the man asked him, 'What are you seeking?' 'I am seeking my brothers,' he said. 'Tell me, please, where they are pasturing the flock.' And the man said, 'They have gone away, for I heard them say, "Let us go to Dothan."' So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan." Now, I just want you to appreciate the series of coincidences in this paragraph. Jacob sends Joseph to check up on his brother's work in Shechem, and it just so happens that his brothers have decided to take their flocks to Dothan. Dothan was about 17 miles north, far away from the prying eyes of any potential witnesses, of anything that might unfold. And it just so happens that when Joseph arrives in Shechem, there's just this guy wandering through the fields that he can talk to. And it just so happens that this guy that he talks to overheard his brothers mention that they were heading to Dothan. And if any of these details had been changed, the rest of this story goes very, very differently. If any of these details of the story changed, everybody dies. And let me explain what I mean. There's something that's coming in this story that nobody realizes yet. In just a few years, there will be a famine. And this famine will affect Egypt, and it will also affect the land of Canaan. And if Joseph doesn't go to Egypt, everybody dies. In a sense, Joseph has to die so that everyone else can live. And so what's about to happen is awful. But God will use it to bring about something great. And even as we see the way these events come together to work together to produce the effect that God wants it to produce, we see the sovereignty of God, who is able to make all things work together for good. Well, as we keep reading in verse 18, Joseph has now gone to find his brothers at Dothan, and it says, they saw him from afar. And before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. They said to one another, here comes this dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we will say that a fierce animal has devoured him, and we will see what will become of his dreams. But when Reuben heard it, he rescued him out of their hands, saying, let us not take his life. And Reuben said to them, shed no blood, throw him into this pit here in the wilderness, but do not lay a hand on him, so that he might rescue him out of their hand to restore him to his father. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the robe of many colors that he wore. And they took him and threw him into a pit. The pit was empty, and there was no water in it. Well, finally, Joseph's brothers have the perfect opportunity to act on the jealousy in their hearts. Their hatred, their envy, it's reached a boiling point. They have motive, and now they have means and opportunity. They probably recognized Joseph's robe even before they recognized his face. Can't you imagine what that would have been like? They're thinking that they are far away from Joseph, they're far away from Jacob, they're in a more remote place where they don't have to think about all of their frustrations, and off in the distance they see somebody approaching, and from a mile away they see that robe. And they think, you've got to be kidding me. Here he comes again. We intentionally tried to get away, but he keeps just making our lives miserable. And can't you imagine how the conversation might have even started out as a joke? Great, here comes the dreamer boy. Hey, you know what would be great? It would be great if we just kill them and toss them into one of these pits. And then somebody else says, yeah, that would be great. We could even just say a wild animal ate him. No one would ever know. And then maybe the idea becomes a little more serious. Maybe one of the brothers asks in a more serious tone, what if we did do that? But when Reuben sees where the conversation is going, he tries to intervene. And maybe it's because he's the oldest. Maybe it's because he feels the most responsible. Like he's the one that's going to have to explain what happened to his father Jacob, or he knows the way that Jacob will feel. But instead of opposing his brother's evil plan, Reuben comes up with an alternative one. He says, why don't we just skip the killing part for now? Like, let's just go ahead and throw him into one of these pits, give him some time to think about these dreams. That'll really show him. And verse 22 tells us that Reuben's plan was to come back and get him out later. Maybe once tensions die down just a little bit. And so in verse 23, they stripped Joseph of his robe and they threw him into the pit. In verse 24, they threw him in. As we continue in verse 25, it says, then they sat down to eat. And looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing gum, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers, what profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh. And his brothers listened to him. Then Midianite traders passed by, and they drew Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. They took Joseph to Egypt. Now, apparently, Reuben has left for some reason, and in his absence, Judah sees an opportunity approaching. Joseph is down in the pit, the brothers are just having a picnic, and Reuben is away, but then off in the distance, they see a caravan of traders traveling to Egypt with valuable commodities, and they're about to pass by. And as they see the commodities that they have, things like gum and balm and myrrh, somebody gets the idea that maybe they would be interested in some human trafficking. Maybe they would be interested in a slave that they could sell as well. Now, the text refers to them as both Ishmaelites and Midianites, and it appears to me that the text uses those terms interchangeably. That's probably because Ishmaelite is the more generic term for these Arab nomads out in the desert, and Midianite's the more specific term that refers to their ethnicity. But in any case, these Midianite or Ishmaelite traders are passing by, and Judah speaks up to his brothers and he says, "Hey, we could kill Joseph and just be rid of him. Or we could sell him and make a little money and be rid of him just the same." And his brothers hear that proposal and agree to it. And so they draw Joseph up, lift him out of the pit, and sell him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver and take Joseph to Egypt. Well, now, here's the end of the chapter. Verse 29 says, "When Reuben returned to the pit and saw that Joseph was not in the pit, he tore his clothes and returned to his brothers and said, 'The boy is gone, and I, where shall I go?' Then they took Joseph's robe and slaughtered a goat and dipped the robe in the blood. And they sent the robe of many colors and brought it to their father and said, 'This we have found. Please identify whether it is your son's robe or not.' And he identified it and said, 'It is my son's robe. A fierce animal has devoured him. Joseph is without doubt torn to pieces.' Then Jacob tore his garments and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. All his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted and said, 'No, I shall go down to Sheol to my son, mourning.' Thus his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard." Now, as we talked about earlier, Reuben is the oldest of the sons, and perhaps that's why he's the one who is most mindful of his responsibility for Joseph's welfare. And he's the only one who's wise enough to know that they shouldn't actually go through with their plan to murder Joseph. But when he sees that Joseph is gone, he loses it. He says, "What am I going to do now?" You know, his whole plan was to come back and rescue him after the hatred had kind of died down a little bit. But now Joseph is halfway to Egypt. And so the solution is a cover-up. They tear up the robe. They cover it in goat's blood. They bring it to Jacob. They ask him, "Is this whose we think it is?" And then we see the grief of a father, mourning the cruel death of his beloved son. Now that is the opening chapter of this story. And I think it's a pretty exciting story, and it's an exciting opening act. Hopefully it makes you curious for the way this story continues to unfold. But even in its opening scenes, what we see in this story is a story that is filled with messianic typology. Every step of the way, there are pictures and glimpses and images of Christ who will fulfill these things in even more powerful ways than Joseph did. And that's because Jesus is the true and better Joseph. I'd like you to consider some similarities. Just like Joseph, Jesus is his father's beloved son. And you remember when Jesus told Mary, his mother, about the role that God had given him, it says in Luke 2, in verse 51, that she treasured up all these things in her heart. Kind of reminds you of Jacob, who kept the saying in mind when Joseph revealed his dreams. When Jesus examined the work of the shepherds of Israel, he gave a bad report of what he found. Matthew 23 is a series of woes and condemnations pronounced to the scribes and to the Pharisees, people who had been entrusted with being the religious leaders, the shepherds of God's people. And it was his criticisms of them that incited their hatred of him. In fact, Matthew 27 in verse 18 says it was out of envy that his brethren delivered him up. We also see that Jesus was sold for the price of a slave. For someone Joseph's age, this was actually 20 shekels of silver. You can read about that in Leviticus 27 in verse 5. For a slave that was between the ages of 5 and 20 years old, the price of a slave was 20 shekels of silver. Jesus was sold for the standard price of an adult slave, which was 30 pieces of silver, according to Exodus 21 and verse 32. Like Joseph, Jesus was stripped of his robe in Matthew 27 and verse 31. Like Joseph, Jesus had to go down into the pit so that he could provide salvation to those who are guilty of his death. He didn't die to save his friends, he died to save his enemies. And in Hebrew, the realm of the dead is sometimes called Sheol. And there are some instances where that word is actually translated as the pit, especially in the Psalms. And so think about this. Joseph went down into the pit. It was necessary in order for him to provide salvation in some small, limited physical way. But Jesus went down into the actual pit. Jesus went down into the grave. Jesus went to the realm of the dead in order to provide salvation for us. But just as with Joseph, Jesus was not abandoned in the pit by God. God was with him, and he rose from it. In Acts chapter 2 and verse 27, Peter is preaching on the day of Pentecost. And to make the point that Jesus is the Messiah, he quotes from Psalm 16 and verse 10, where there it says, "You will not abandon my soul to Sheol, or let your Holy One see corruption." Just like God was with Joseph and delivered him from the pit, God was with Jesus, and he rose again. And now, the sun, moon, and stars worship Jesus. In Revelation chapter 12, there's a vision of a woman. And it's a little bit of a complicated vision, and so I hope my point is not too complicated to see. But in that chapter, this woman represents the people of God. In Revelation 12, we see her actually giving birth to the Messiah. And when you think about that, that means that she represents the people of God. She represents the nation of Israel. But as the chapter goes on, what we see is that she stands in for the church, the bride of Christ. She is nourished by God in the wilderness, just like God takes care of us as Satan tries to pursue us. But what's interesting about that vision is that in Revelation 12 and verse 1, She's described like this: a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. I think maybe that should make us think of Joseph's vision. Joseph had a vision or a dream that he would be exalted into a place of prominence, that the sun, the moon, and the stars would bow down at his feet, that after he had gone through this period of humbling and discouragement and suffering, and in a sense, death, that he would be lifted up to a place of glory. And all of that shows us exactly what Jesus has done. After his death, after his pain, after his suffering, after all of the darkness of his life, God has raised him up. He's seated at the right hand of the throne of God. And he is worshipped by the sun, the moon, and the stars. You see, the story of Joseph is a story that is ultimately all about Jesus. It's a story about how God can take terrible circumstances and terrible situations and bring about blessings. How he can take something ugly and make it something beautiful. And the ultimate example of God doing that is in the gospel of Jesus Christ. God can take terrible circumstances and bring blessing into them. God can speak light into darkness. It's powerfully demonstrated with what God does in the life of Joseph, and it's ultimately demonstrated in what God has done through his own son.